This is the voice of Carnage, and you are listening to Carnage Cast.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 14 of Carnage Cast. This week on the show, we go back to Periton Publishing, learning about some of the projects of its Dark Empress, Robin Lee. She talks about running games at Carnage, her Kaladar setting, and writing fiction. Then, in Autopsy of a Game, Dan and I discuss Betrayal at House on the Hill, a cult favorite of horror gamers that recently received a reprint slash second edition after a long time away. Now let's get Interview with the Gamer underway. Here's Robin Lee of Periton Publishing.
Now, Interview with the Gamer.
Hi, I'm sitting here with Robin Lee, alleged Dark Queen of Periton Publishing. How are you, your Empress?
Doing fine, thank you.
Awesome. How's your convention been going?
Oh, great. I love this convention. Mm-hmm. Carnage is one of my favorites.
How long have you been coming?
This is my third year.
Okay. What brought you out here? Because you're not native to, or you're not local to the New England.
Right. We're in Cleveland. So, Tom knew someone online, and I'm not sure who it was originally, but somebody suggested it to us, and we just kind of came out to check it out. And
well, glad to have you here. Just, you guys have a good mix of games that we don't normally get.
Well, thank you. It's a fun place to run more experimental stuff. Mm-hmm. I kind of have fun. I like to try stuff out here because mm-hmm. it seems like it gets more reception than some of the other cons where they're looking for a specific, you know, the usual menu games.
Right. What did you run this year?
This year I ran a game I'm developing. I haven't published it yet. It's based on the one that I have published, Periton, our role-playing game. Mm-hmm. And I'm testing some new rules. I'm designing to Periton role-playing game. It has more of a generic heroic fantasy flavor, sort of the standard D20 sort of thing, mm-hmm. except it's the slimmed down is the main thing about it. Right. And the game I'm developing has more of its own flavor. It'll have more personality of its own.
So how did your adventures go this year?
Very well. I got some good feedback. I got the people I ran the game for were really good players mm-hmm. and had some good ideas for me. And I thought for my own stuff, it really seemed to click for me. I think it's one of the better scenarios I've run, and it really played out well.
Great. I remember you had a full table yesterday afternoon.
Yeah, and that was a bit of a surprise because last time I checked, I only had like three people who were going to continue. I had a full table, or almost a full table, for part one, and then I thought I was only going to have a few people for the second part, but then I had some last minute additions, and it filled out completely. Mm-hmm.
So these are experimental in that you're still developing them, taking feedback from the players.
Yes, exactly.
Where are you hoping to go with this?
How do you mean?
I mean, are you in the refining stage? Are you going to publish? Is this?
I mean to publish it eventually. Yes, mm-hmm. maybe. Probably not in 2012, more likely 2013, mm-hmm. but I'm not sure. I'm because I'm still working on that. I do plan to publish it at some point. Yes.
Okay. Do you have any specific inspiration you're drawing on or sources you're drawing on to inform this?
Nothing too specific, I suppose. I mean, it is a loosely developed on a. It's an elaboration of a setting that I had published before called Kaladar, mm-hmm. and that setting was written for the True 20 game. And I wanted to, I enjoy True 20. I think it's a great system. I wanted to develop this more for my own system. I think it's a good fit.
Okay. Can you tell me more about Kaladar?
The concept is essentially that it's an other world. Mm-hmm. It's sort of where things go when they don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Not like Land of the Dead or anything. It's where living people can go there, but the places are dead. Mm-hmm. That's the essential concept.
And, okay. How does it figure into like a role-playing game? Is it a place to go, a place to live?
I'm not sure if I'm using the term correctly. I think of it as kind of a meta setting. It's something that you can have your basic setting as far as the mundane world, and Kaladar is sort of sitting behind it. Mm-hmm. And it's a thing. So it may not be something... I mean, you could set whole campaigns right there and never leave it. But yep. It's also something that you can have in the background things from there could come into your regular world, or your characters can go there and have adventures there.
So it can have a linking effect for different genres and worlds.
Yes, yes.
Cool. Do you have any other projects you're working on for 2012 or the near future?
I have two stories that are connected to Kaladar out now. It has taken an encouragingly long period of time to get a response, so I'm hopeful that they're in the final consideration.
What means of publishing is Periton using?
Mostly we've used Publish on Demand. We do have a distributor who has put some of our products in stores. The Periton RPG is in distribution. Kaladar is. Mm-hmm. One of our anthologies is Troll Tunnels, mm-hmm. which was a heroic fantasy anthology. Mm-hmm. I believe that's it.
Okay.
But for the future, yeah. The one I'm working on, the so far unnamed role playing game that I've been testing, that one is I'm planning to try and actually acquire a bit more seed funds to go ahead and do a large print run of that and put it directly into distribution instead of going the print on demand route.
Mm-hmm. Have you experimented with PDF sales at all?
Oh yeah, yeah. Okay. PDF sales really keep us going. It's a great way to get the stuff out there fast, but people see it. Yeah, we have a lot of our products are on DriveThru RPG, whatever other One Bookshelf affiliates I use. So.
Okay. If people want to learn more about Periton Publishing and the games you design, where should they go?
There's our website, periotonpublishing.com, and that links to other, like I said, the PDF sales site and those things, and they'll have a description of other products.
That's a central place to go for all those links to buy stuff.
Yes, yes.
Cool.
And
how do you spell Periton?
Periton.
Publishing.
And it's Periton, yes, it's all like it's one word, Periton Publishing. And then .com, and that'll get you there.
Cool.
There's a forum there. If you have questions, if people have questions or want to discuss something, mm-hmm. So
you're very available.
Very available. Yes.
Nice. Well, thanks for talking, Robin.
Thank you.
And I'm glad. I hope you had a good weekend.
I had a great weekend. Like I said, this is one of my favorite conventions. I look forward to this every year.
Awesome. Glad to hear it. So safe ride home.
Thank you.
Next, we take you to an autopsy of a game.
Hi, Dan. How are you doing today?
I'm very well.
Yeah?
Yes. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, we're always happy to have you back here. This time on Autopsy of a Game, we're talking Betrayal at House on the Hill.
Yes.
And that's it's a game from 2002, as I recall.
2004.
2004.
Second edition was in 2010.
Oh.
I never played the first edition.
They are highly similar, as we'll find out as we get into what the game is about and what it's like. Because in Betrayal at House on the Hill, everybody has a character.
Yes.
And they are characters of that sort of broadly painted, campy horror variety.
It's Scooby-Doo.
It is. It's Scooby-Doo. You might be a fortune teller, or the girl in the midriff exposing shirt.
Or the creepy little girl, or the high school athlete.
Yep. And for whatever...
There's no dog, though.
You can find a dog.
True. That's true. You can find a dog.
Because the way the game starts is you all have your characters, and with different ability scores, and what happens is, for some inexplicable reason, they've all decided to go exploring a haunted house together.
Yes, even though some of them, you can't imagine how they'd even know each other.
Right.
But that doesn't matter.
No, apparently, maybe someone set up a tweet up.
Or they're all just, you know, they all grew up, they all live in the same neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're going into this haunted house, which is constructed using tiles. There's not as many tiles as some other of these tile-type games. It's possible to have similar configurations, but it's going to be pretty different every time.
Yep.
You start on the foyer in the first floor, and then as you go on, rooms show up. There's all kinds of interesting rooms in this house.
Yeah, you can open a door and maybe find a room smeared with blood, or you might find the kitchen.
Yep. They might even be the same room. Mm-hmm. Actually, they're not. But they might be near each other. The thing that sometimes I find very amusing is where the rooms wind up. Like, you'll have the dining room and the kitchen being nowhere near each other.
Or separated by a corridor of statuary.
Yes, which is just... Whoever owned the house clearly had interesting tastes in architecture.
Or, depending on the scenario you find yourself in, because that's something we'll get to in a second, it could be that the house itself moves around.
Yes. So you go through the house, and everything's fine. You're just exploring the house like a bunch of kids might do in a haunted house with their, you know, buddy Professor Longfellow and some gypsy woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're exploring around, and sometimes you find an item. Sometimes you have an encounter of some sort.
You might see a shadow on the wall or phantom footsteps.
Or you might find, you know, a pistol or
the dark dice.
The dark dice, which have spelled the doom of many a young adventurer.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually you're going to, however, have these omens.
Right.
And you have an omen. There's three decks. There's an item deck, a encounter deck, and an omen deck.
Mm-hmm.
The omens are basically just like the items and encounters. But they're a little different, of course, as you know. And something happens. It's usually something vaguely creepy. You might find a spear or a book or something like that.
Or something in the dark bites you.
Oh, the bite's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
Or you might meet the girl or the madman or the dog. But as you have omens, you have to start rolling dice.
Yes, they have what are called these omen checks, where the more omens you have accumulated, the more likely you are going to trigger the haunt.
Right. Which is the second half of the game. Is the What's the first called? The exploration?
I call it exploration, yeah. You have exploration, then you, once the haunt is triggered by having rolled sufficiently low with sufficient number of omens on the table, the second phase of the game begins, where it turns out that somebody in the group is a traitor of some
sort.
Well,
not sort. Always. There's a
typically.
Couple.
There are a couple, but...
A couple with no traitor, but...
The norm is somebody in the group is a traitor and has lured everybody here for some nefarious purpose.
Or they've gone mad, and they're planning, they've joined the dark forces of the house, or who knows.
Yep.
And that's determined with a nice chart where, what is it, the room that it occurred in and the omen that was drawn.
Mm-hmm.
And then you refer to another book and find out what haunt it is.
Right.
The traitor goes away. The person playing the traitor goes off and reads his manual, mm-hmm. her manual, the traitor's manual. Everybody else reads the hero's manual because we become heroes at that point, don't we?
Survivors.
Survivors, yes. We read that manual. The last time we played, you wound up being the traitor.
Yep.
So you went away and you read yours, and we read ours, and it was something about an earthquake, I think, and rooms were collapsing. Oh, it was falling into hell.
Yes.
That's right.
The abyss had opened up in the foundations.
And for whatever reason, you had decided that hell sounded good, and you were going to join that team. So we just had to stop you.
And you did an excellent job of it.
Oh, we killed you right away.
As people will find out once we put up the play recording.
Yes, that's right. We recorded this.
Mm-hmm. And people will be able to hear that in the future. So in the second phase, suddenly it's slightly less cooperative. Betrayal uses this thing I call many against one, where instead of everybody working together to beat the rules of the game, like you might have in an Arkham Horror or a Pandemic, it's everybody's fighting against one person who is in turn fighting against the rest of them.
Yes.
You see it also in Descent and Mansions of Madness.
Yep, and HeroQuest back in the old days,
mm-hmm.
from the 80s. Somebody played the Keeper.
Mm-hmm.
But this one's a little different in that everybody's cooperative for a little while, until they're not.
Well, that's a strategy thing. I found the more you play the game, the more that initial exploration phase involves everybody getting as far away from everybody else as possible.
Ah, and trying to get the best stuff.
Right. You're still running around accumulating stuff, trying to find the stat bumps and all that. But I personally try to stay as far away from everybody else as possible.
That's a good point. I hadn't really thought about that. I haven't played Betrayal as much as you have, but yeah, that makes perfect sense. You want to explore, you want to find stuff, you want to be nowhere near people who are going to stab you the instant the game turns.
Right, because that's pretty much what happened in the game we played.
And you weren't even that close to anyone.
No, it's just someone happened to be really fast.
Yeah, and he ran right down. I gave him a spear. He ran right downstairs and stabbed you with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty terrible, actually. Although that didn't even end the game.
No, it didn't, because the traitor player winds up accumulating some nifty extra abilities. Either the character itself, because they found a weapon, or they've been infused with demonic energies, or suddenly there's a horde of things running through the house trying to attack all the hapless heroes. Or not so hapless, as the case may be, because they... Depending on how lucky you are and what you find, you can be pretty well armed.
Yes, I believe I had a pistol and some dynamite by the end of that game.
Yeah, that's the high end of the scale. This isn't an Arkham Horror where everybody's armed for bear.
No. The pistol and the dynamite's pretty good.
Yeah. And so in that in the second traitor slash survival phase, both sides of the equation have a different win condition and ways of going about it.
Yes.
And there's a lot of information management and what you say at the table.
Oh, yeah. You don't want to clue in the traitor's player too much about what you're planning.
Mm-hmm.
Because that player might then prepare for it, might avoid areas where he could get bogged down, might...
Or they know which rooms to clog up with monsters to protect them from heroes.
Which hero to try to take out.
Mm-hmm. Who's got the right item that needs to be stolen.
In our game, killing your character didn't matter. But in some games, some traitor scenarios, the goal is to find and kill the traitor.
Yeah, but usually that traitor has become significantly more powerful.
Yes.
In this particular scenario, that wasn't the case. And the traitor only existed as a speed bump to irritate the heroes.
Yes. Because once we got rid of you, we still had to go doing other things while you killed at least one of us.
Yep. I got 1 out of 5.
Poor Professor Longfellow.
He just wasn't fast enough.
Should have stayed out of the basement. It's good advice.
And yet the game works really hard to draw you down into that basement.
Oh, yeah. In general, a lot of the spiffy rooms and special rooms are in the basement.
Yep.
But it's also very dangerous.
Yes. Because it's part of the tile arrangement, is some rooms will always be on certain levels of the house.
Yep, there's 3 levels of the house. There's the main floor, the upper floor, and the basement. And on the back of every tile, it says what floors that tile is good for.
Mm-hmm.
So when you've walked into a room in the upper floor,
mm-hmm.
if you draw a tile, if the top tile on the thing just says basement, well, you discard it and go to the next one until you find one that's appropriate to the upper floor.
Right. But there are certain rooms where you can fall into the basement or climb up to the second floor.
Yep.
And that's part of what creates the crazy arrangement of rooms, is not knowing how you're going to wind up where you wind up.
Yeah, you can walk into a room and, oh, no, you're in the basement now.
Mm-hmm.
Or, oh, it's the magic elevator.
I love that magic elevator.
It's going to go somewhere. Who knows?
The traitor always knows.
Does the traitor always know?
The traitor can take that elevator wherever they like.
Really? That's a standard?
Mm-hmm.
That's very convenient for the traitor.
It is. And I think it's one of those instances where they're trying to make the game more balanced, because in my personal experience, it tends to be very swingy. Either the heroes essentially have a lock on winning, and it's just a matter of taking the time to go through all the motions, or it's the traitor who's got a lock on winning, and it's just a question of how long it takes them to murder everybody.
Yeah, well, that is a problem. I haven't played the game enough to see too much of that. I've probably only seen 3 or 4 of the different haunts.
Mm-hmm.
But they are... There's some good ones.
Oh, there those traitorless scenarios you mentioned earlier are some of the best, I think.
Oh, really?
There's a particular one called Airborne that I love.
I think you've mentioned that.
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to give anything away about it beyond to say that there's no traitor because everybody is desperately fighting for their own survival.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of everybody's a traitor.
Yeah.
Shoot your friends. Who doesn't love that?
So, one of the nice things about Betrayal is it's highly replayable.
Yes.
Because
there's got to be, what, 25 haunts?
I think it's almost 50.
Is it really that many? All right, so 50 haunts, yeah. And the board is different almost every time.
Yep, and you never know. The characters themselves can vary because they're all double-sided with differences in stats.
What is it, 10 different characters?
12, because there's 6 players.
Up to 6 players, so there's 12 different characters with slightly different stats. There's anybody who... The traitor is often randomly determined.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's... There you go. Well, not really randomly determined, but it could be anybody.
Nobody playing the game has any control over who the traitor is going to be.
It's a good thing. Mm-hmm. It's got a lot of replay value.
Yep. And it's developed a real cult following, because, like you said, it came out in 2004. And the funny thing there is, it did not do well at all. It stank up the store to the point that Wizards of the Coast's retail franchise, which they had at the time, was selling it for $5 a copy.
My God.
Just to get them out of the house. Same thing for Toys R Us and other places selling them. And then the game found its cult following after it was out of print, and copies would regularly sell for $80 on eBay.
Oh, my.
Yeah. That was with the original edition. That went on until 2010, just last year, when Wizards republished the game.
To great fanfare.
Yeah, to great fanfare for the people who'd been anticipating it. I don't know if it was a smash hit on the market.
Well, I bought a copy.
Yeah, so did I.
Actually, I didn't. I was given that.
Aw.
Someone paid for it.
It contributed. Right, so in 2010, they republished the game. They changed the box art. Everything inside the box is identical, essentially.
All the art's the same?
The art is completely identical. I think they commissioned one or two new pieces for a couple new cards. But it all looks the same otherwise, right down to the decorations on the books. All they did was clean up the rules and the scenarios, because some of them were essentially unwinnable or unlosable. And it goes back to that very swingy thing, where
right.
one scenario may be super easy to win. And that was about all they did for the second edition cleanup. But in the meantime, before that second edition, people were still creating content for it. I've seen alternate characters that are the Scooby Gang. I've seen a whole book of alternate scenarios for people to try out. I really actually want to print that out and give it a go, because it's completely compatible with the second edition.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, none of the contents have changed enough to make it to not work.
Well, we should do that.
Yeah. And I think that whoever wrote it had all the benefit of hindsight from first edition that went into the second. Because first was actually really notorious for how drastically it was rewritten, rules-wise.
Oh, really?
You could download a whole alternate rule book with not a lot of similarity to the one that came with the game.
I guess it definitely had a cult following.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of games that have a lot of user-generated content that can be quite hit or miss, but...
Right, and it tends to be more of these adventure-oriented games. Arkham Horror, Betrayal at House on the Hill, Talisman, all have this sort of wide-open sensibility to them that anybody can... that everybody feels comfortable jumping on board and putting their own...
Well, why not?
...creativity
out there. There are a whole Arkham Horror expansions available online.
Yes.
And Machinations of the Mego.
Mm-hmm. Cult of the Golden Scarab.
Yes, I saw that one too, yeah.
And that sort of gets into that whole DIY ethos, as well as how do I make this match the rest of the game so it'll work together.
Yeah, so it'll function together. And there's... I didn't know there was a lot for Betrayal at House on the Hill, but it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
I'm sure Mansions of Madness will have the same thing.
Yep. We'll see how that one goes. Fantasy Flight seems to be taking it very easy.
What, Mansions of Madness?
Yeah.
Yeah, they haven't put out any real expansions for it. There's some downloadable stuff.
Yeah, I think they're experimenting with print-on-demand a lot for it. Like, I know they release a scenario or a small set of pieces, things like that, that they could produce easily.
Yeah.
Because Mansions is super bit-intensive.
Yes, it is.
With
there
a lot.
Are a lot of little bits in that.
Including some very nice figures.
Yes. But yes, Betrayal at House on the Hill is an excellent game published by Avalon Hill, which is the coast.
Yeah, Avalon Hill is an imprint dating back from the 70s.
They bought it that long? Oh, yeah, Avalon Hill is quite old. I've got some old Avalon Hill games right there, you can see.
So he does.
Elric, Maharaja, Blackbeard.
Mm-hmm.
I've even got Space Amoebas somewhere.
Golly.
Golly, yeah.
I want to get those cleaned up.
Yeah, well. Do Wizards put out the first edition as well?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, yep. We discussed that. That's right.
Right. The first edition was also part of their initial wave of Avalon Hill titles.
Okay.
Like, it seemed that they had acquired the name and then put out a lot of new board game content under it, most of which didn't take off the way they hoped, I think.
That's one of the risks in gaming.
It's a particularly heavy risk in that tabletop games don't have a lot of development time in them. It seems that a game is designed, gets a small amount of testing from whatever the designer can rustle up, and then it goes to print.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And then that first edition run is often where you find your mistakes.
Yeah, there's some pretty slapdash stuff out there sometimes.
Which isn't to say that people didn't work hard on it. It's that it's more testament to how inventive people can be in breaking a game.
Yeah, they just didn't find the various problems with it, and mm-hmm. that's just the way it goes sometimes.
Yep, and it's interesting to watch the ebb and flow of that across editions if a game lives long enough to have multiple iterations. People discover things about it, and that informs the way it's redesigned, and then people learn more things, and that informs the second redesign.
I agree. And then that's why sometimes you want to buy later editions of things.
Yeah, it's that early adopters in board games in particular can get punished.
Yeah.
But then they also get that single edition of a game that is never made again.
That's true. The one with the ridiculous rules that you can always win.
Right. Or just the only set that's ever made.
True.
So it's a trade-off. All right, so I think we've done a good job autopsying betrayal at House on the Hill.
That's right. I've been betrayed at House on the Hill.
No, I was betrayed.
You were not betrayed. You were the traitor.
That's true. I felt betrayed.
That's because we murdered you.
That's like a betrayal.
Kind of.
Yeah. You betrayed my will to live.
It's very active betrayal.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, here, take this spear and go find that and jam it into her.
Right.
It worked.
So, Betrayal at House on the Hill. It's published by Wizards of the Coast. You may find Avalon Hill's name on the box. You can find it pretty much anywhere you're going to find hobby games.
Yeah, it's pretty easy to find.
Yeah, and it's in that $50 price bracket.
I think it is $50.
Yeah, that's become the de facto price for something of that size and complexity in terms of production.
Pretty much.
All right, thanks, Dan.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Carnage Cast, a production of NNEG LLC. All rights reserved. For more information, visit us at www.carnagecon.com.
If you look here, everyone is having so much fun along the Ganges. And when it floods, we will all weep. Weep. Deep, deep tears of blood.